Tom Briggs of Morris Nichols. I'd like to introduce my co-counsel, Martin Blur of Linklaters. With the court's permission, Mr. Blur will make the argument on behalf of Appalese today.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Good afternoon.
I know it's been a long day for you, and I come up here with some trepidation on a LLC contract interpretation argument after a long morning, but here we go. May it please the court. The primary issue of law raised by this appeal is whether the DresCap certificates owned by Commerce Bank are parity securities under the Commerce Bank II LLC agreement. The Court of Chancery found that the trustee's reading flowed somewhat more naturally than the bank's, but chose to depart from the more natural reading and instead found that the trailing modifier, subject to any guarantee or support undertaking, modified all three categories of securities preceding it instead of modifying the closest antecedent. This was legal error for three reasons. First, the COBA II trust preferred securities held by the trustee and the people that purchased them, which are treated by the bank as consolidated Tier 1 capital, were contractually entitled to be treated equally with other Tier 1 capital of the bank. The DresCap 1 securities are Tier 1 consolidated capital of the bank and therefore qualify as parity securities. Second, even though the court acknowledged that the trustee's reading of parity securities definition was the more natural one, the court resorted to the definition of exclusive or inclusive or to deviate from the more natural reading of the parity securities definition. But inclusive or was not a relevant interpretive aid to determine what trailing modifiers actually modify. And third, the lower court committed legal error because the lower court's construction results in the treatment of the middle term, that is preference shares or other instruments qualifying as Tier 1 capital, consolidated Tier 1 capital of the bank, reads it as surplusage, whereas the trustee's reading gives meaning to this important term of the definition of parity securities. I'd like to start with a brief background on the governing documents in dispute because they are somewhat complex and dense. To reduce it to its simplest terms, the trust structure involves the bank, the LLC controlled by the bank, and a trust. And the trust issues the securities which are purchased by the investors, known as trust preferred securities, along with related agreements.
Just with one fact question about that. It is unusual. Is that because of some regulatory provision from the EU, or is it U.S. tax driven? Why the structure?
So it is a very good question, and the answer to it is the reason why it's structured this way is because these instruments have qualities of both equity and debt. And in order under the regulatory scheme to be treated as Tier 1 capital, you have to have these underlying agreements to support them. It's a regulatory issue to answer the question directly. So in 2006, the bank, Commerce Bank, sold to the LLC a subordinated note for £800 million. The LLC, which was controlled by the bank, in turn issued Trust Class B preferred securities. Then the trust ultimately sold to the investors the trust preferred securities at issue here, held by the controlled by the trustee. Now, the trusts were extremely advantageous to the bank. They could be counted as Tier 1 capital, which, as we've explained in our brief, Tier 1 capital is gold for banks because it determines how healthy a bank is. It was very important that it be qualified as Tier 1 capital. Now, the trust structure that we have here is not unique to Commerce Bank. Many banks took advantage of trust preferred securities and this structure under the regulatory scheme to boost up their Tier 1 capital. The bank, after they issued the COBA II trusts, which we're here on today, issued a additional series of trusts like the COBA III trusts. And, as we know, when Dresdner Bank was acquired by Commerce Bank, the Dresdner Bank trusts became those of Commerce Bank and were treated by the bank advantageously as Tier 1 capital of Commerce Bank. The COBA II TRUPS pay a coupon on April 12th of each year, dependent on a profit-based test under the LLC agreement. But there's an important protection for these securities, and that is there's a pusher provision which protects the COBA II TRUPS from unequal treatment with other parity securities. Now, the pusher provision provides if the bank paid out on a parity security or a junior security, that a payment had to be made on the COBA II TRUPS. This is the protection that the bank provided the TRUPS investors from unequal treatment when compared to other Tier 1 capital. And this is the fundamental equitable point of this case, and that is, what did these investors who had no say in the drafting of these documents get for protection? Their protection was to be treated the same as other Tier 1 capital of the bank, which the DRESCAP 1 and 4 securities became upon the acquisition of DRESCAP by Commerce Bank. The investors did not negotiate these transaction documents. The investors held these TRUPS, the COBA II TRUPS, which were non-cumulative preferred securities that had few protections to be paid. Again, the advantage to the bank is Tier 1 capital, such as these TRUPS, can absorb losses of the bank, and therefore, again, are a cushion for the bank and determine how healthy the bank is. The TRUPS had roughly a 6% coupon that paid on April 12th of every year. The bank failed to make the coupon payments starting April 12th of 2010, even though the DRESCAP 1 securities were paid on in 2009, and that's what brings us here today. So why is the trustee's reading correct that the DRESCAP 1 securities are parity securities? Well, as the lower court recognized, the trustee's reading is the more natural reading. There should not be any dispute about this being the more natural reading. There's evidence in the record that Commerce Bank recognized since 2009 when it acquired the DRESCAP 1 and 4 securities that they were parity securities. So there should be no dispute here today that the more natural reading of this provision, the reading that was given to it by Commerce Bank.
Didn't the Vice Chancellor say that type of purported admission, you can't look to it if the language is plain?
He said you could not look to it in terms of an issue of estoppel. That is correct. He did hold that. But in terms of confirmation that the more natural reading is the one accorded it by the bank, as far as I'm aware, there's no prohibition in the law in confirming that position by looking at exactly how the bank treated it, which shows you that it is the more natural reading, which under rules of construction is an important guidepost to determine how a provision should be interpreted.
But you're going outside the document itself because of why? It's ambiguous?
Well, typically, you go outside the document only in terms of an ambiguity. My argument today is the lower court found that the lower court deviated from what was the more natural reading, and the record evidence shows that the natural reading is the one that was given to Commerce Bank, namely that these were parity securities, the DRESCAP 1 securities and 4 were parity securities, and it's confirmation of the lower court's point, namely that it is the more natural reading because that's how the bank also interpreted it.
This ruling, embodied in a very detailed opinion, was basically on cross motions for summary judgment?
It was.
Had the court found that both sides' reading of the critical language was reasonable and therefore there was an ambiguity that required a live hearing, would there be any additional evidence that your side would have put into the record?
I don't think there is, Your Honor. I mean, this is based on a stipulated record. I think all of the evidence that bore on how the bank looked at these securities was in the record. If you look at the appeal record right now, there isn't really any evidence contesting that's the position that the bank took. So even in the event of an ambiguity, it would be our position that there's no need for a remand. And there's no need for a remand also because if it's ambiguous, contra pro forentum would also apply here. And the point I made earlier was simply these were documents that these investors had no say in how they were drafted. They understood they had limited protections, but the protections they did get protected them from being treated unequally from other Tier 1 securities. And what we have here is the bank taking the position that these were parity securities after they acquired the DresCap securities in 2009. And then, frankly, what happened was someone came up with a clever argument under the parity securities definition about how the trailing modifier knocks that out. Well, again, as I say, if we get to the issue of ambiguity, contra-preferendum would apply.
Contra-preferendum.
Yes, yes, correct. So, as I said earlier, the question of Tier 1 capital and its importance to the bank is it's about the bank's health. It's good for the health of the banks because it can absorb other losses and thus is better for the bank as far as its capital structure is concerned. Tier 1 capital includes common stock and other non-cumulative hybrid securities like the securities here. If we turn to the definition of parity securities, we see in subsection 1, it deals with instruments of the bank itself. It talks about the most senior ranking preference shares and also talks about the most senior form of Tier 1 regulatory capital. Again, this provision is all about Tier 1 regulatory capital. Then we go to subsection 2, which deals with instruments of affiliates of the bank. So you cover both instruments of the bank in subsection 1 and you deal with affiliates of the bank in subsection 2. Subsection 2 talks about consolidated Tier 1 regulatory capital of the bank, or a guarantee and support agreement of the bank ranking pari passu with the obligations of the bank under the support undertaking. Again, the yardstick being used in the provision here is consolidated Tier 1 regulatory capital of the bank. The parity securities definition is all about tier and ranking. The bank could have chosen other measuring sticks to determine whether parity securities qualified. They could have used a profit-based test, for instance, if it wanted to say that was what a parity security is. But the bank did not choose that. It chose Tier 1 capital to be the yardstick to measure whether something was a parity security. Now, how did the Chancery Court go astray? Rather than following the more natural reading, the one that an investor looking at this would assume that Tier 1 regulatory capital, if it got paid on, there would be a push, the Chancery Court looked to the definition of or in the trust agreement. The trustee argued below that the DresCap securities were parity securities under subsection 2 of the definition of parity securities, and therefore a payment was pushed. We have cited various secondary sources from the Manual of Contract Drafting, from the Dictionary of Legal Usage, and others that show that the concept of inclusive or exclusive or has nothing to do with determining whether a trailing modifier modifies things preceding it. For instance, inclusive or is used to determine whether if you have A or B, the question is whether it's A or B or both, or A or B, but not both. It is relevant to that inquiry, but it has nothing to do with determining what a trailing modifier eventually modifies. This was the basis of the court's decision, the inclusive or analysis, which, as I hope I've just explained, is not relevant to an analysis of what a trailing modifier modifies. The court made a mistake using the wrong yardstick. The court's interpretation also fails to give meaning to this essential middle term, and that is of hybrid, Tier 1 hybrid capital, consolidated capital. The trustee's more natural reading of subsection 2, where other instruments qualifying as consolidated Tier 1 regulatory capital include the DresCap certificates, is the only reading that gives meaning to this middle term. If, as the bank suggests, the middle term is modified by the trailing modifier, the subject to language, then there would be no need for the middle term because the affiliate instruments would already be covered under the third term here other instruments subject to a support agreement, guarantee or support agreement. It would already be covered under the final term of the parity securities deposition and therefore is rendered surplusage. The trustee's position is also supported by the definition of junior securities. If you look to the definition of junior securities, which the lower court did, by the way, as part of its inclusive or analysis, the lower court failed to appreciate the distinction or the difference in the language between the definition of parity securities and junior securities. Subsection 2 of the junior securities definition does not contain the critical language, quote, other instruments qualifying as consolidated Tier 1 regulatory capital of the bank, the key language in the parity securities definition. This inclusion of that language in the parity securities definition, but exclusion of it in the junior securities definition, must mean that it has some meaning in the parity securities definition, which, of course, the lower court's decision gives it no meaning. Otherwise, it would already be covered by the last term of the definition of parity securities. You would expect to see language in the junior securities provision paralleling the language in the parity securities provision, namely that consolidated Tier 1 regulatory capital would rank junior to parity securities. But it's not there. It's not covered there. The trustee's reading is the only reading that harmonizes these two definitions. The trustee's reading eliminates the discrepancy by covering all of Tier 1 consolidated regulatory instruments as parity securities with no consolidated Tier 1 regulatory capital instruments to be included in the junior securities definition. The lower court deviated from the more natural reading, misapplied the inclusive or concept, failed to give significance to the important language differences between the parity securities and the junior securities, and rendered the operative language of the Dres Cap covering the Dres Cap 1 securities surplusage. It also used as examples to render the definition, in the court's words, clearer by inserting language. This is in the court's lengthy footnote. The court inserted the language provided in each case to make the meaning more clear. But this proves the trustee's point. Inserting the language is a dramatic change to the more natural reading to make something more clear. And the ability to add this language was starkly presented on the same page to the drafters. If you look on the same page, those words were used and underlined for the definition of permitted investments on each page, the words provided in each case, on the very same page and underlined. But the drafters chose not to use those words for the parity securities definition. The trustee's reading, which is the more natural reading, gives effect to the middle term, is consistent with the rule of the last antecedent, and provides the COBA II TRUPS the protection from unequal treatment with other Tier 1 capital. I'd like to turn now to the pusher provision. Under the plain reading of the pusher provision, the bank's payment on the Dres Cap securities in 2009 caused a deemed declaration to occur in April 2010. The pusher provision has three parts. First is the payment trigger. A payment is triggered when the bank pays any distributions on any parity securities in any fiscal year. And it's undisputed in this record that the bank paid on the Dres Cap 1 on June 30 and December 31st in 2009. The next part of the pusher provision is the timing clause. When are the push payments to be made? Well, they are deemed to be declared and paid on the Class B payment date, falling contemporaneously with or immediately after the date on which such triggering event was made. And for purposes of the LLC agreement, that date is April 12th of each year. And finally is the calculation clause under the pusher provision that tells you how much you pay. You pay 100% if there's 100% payment to the parity security, and it's prorated to the extent that the parity security was not paid at 100%. Now, ignoring the plain and unambiguous language of the pusher provision, the bank argues that if it made a payment on a parity security with respect to a given year, or with respect to a fiscal year, it makes a payment with respect to that fiscal year. Well, nowhere will you see those limitations in the language used in the pusher provision. That's not what the plain language of the pusher provision says. The bank's interpretation requires the reader to change the words "in any fiscal year" in the pusher provision to "payments with respect to the immediately prior fiscal year." That's same for the plain language "during the fiscal year in which such payment occurs." The bank's reading requires the court to rewrite the provision and change it to "with respect to the fiscal year immediately before the fiscal year in which the payment occurs." Now, if there's any question about the plain language of the pusher provision, the court need only look at the definition of the junior securities pusher provision, which confirms the trustee's interpretation, namely that push payments can cross fiscal years. If you look at the junior securities provision, it defines the payment period as when the distribution is made in the Class B payment period preceding the relevant Class B payment date. It's not based on or with respect to a fiscal year. Under the junior securities pusher provision, it's based upon when the payment was made. If the court accepts the bank's interpretation of the pusher provision, namely that a push payment cannot cross fiscal years, then only parity payments made in the first 4 months of the year would be protected. For instance, if there is a parity security payment on April 13th, the day after the April 12th payment date, you can't cross the fiscal year according to the bank's interpretation. Therefore, there would be no payment due for the next year. That just doesn't make sense, that the protection that these investors got was simply for the first 4 months of any fiscal year. I'm chewing up my time for rebuttal, so I'll stop there.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Martin Bloor on behalf of Commerce Bank Capital Funding Trust II, Commerce Bank Capital Funding LLC II, and Commerce Bank AG. I think it makes sense to start by taking a step back and understanding what the bank told investors at the time that the trust preferred securities were issued in 2006. And what was clear from the prospectus was that these trust preferred securities were profit-dependent securities, which meant that capital payments generally occurred only where the bank had distributable profits. The risk factor section of the prospectus clearly set forth that it was a risk that if the bank did not have sufficient profits, payments may not be made on the trust preferred securities. The investors were also told that the documents had a parity security provision. So to the extent that parity securities were paid, that could require a payment on the trust preferred securities. The DRESCAP certificates that were issued in 1999 by Dresdner Bank were not profit dependent. They were based on a capital ratio. So regardless of the profitability of Dresdner Bank in 1999, if there was sufficient capital, if the capital of the bank was sufficient, regardless of profitability, those instruments would be paid. Now, it should be no surprise to the trustee that these instruments issued in 1999 do not fit within the definition of parity security in the 2006 trust preferred security documents. The court below specifically held that the DRESCAP certificates were not parity securities, and we believe that decision should be affirmed. Now, there are
basically two provisions that are in dispute here, one being the definition of parity securities, that is, whether these particular securities that were held by the trustee were parity securities.
That's correct.
One issue. And the other, and tell me if I have it right, is has to do with the proper application of the pusher provision
That's correct, Your Honor, but you only get to the pusher provision.
I understand.
Right, to the extent
of... The first issue is surmounted.
Correct. And we heard the trustee argue that parity securities are essentially Tier 1 instruments, and that's simply not the case. What you need to do is you need to look to the definition in the LLC agreement of parity securities. And what that definition says is, as the trustee pointed out, Section 1 deals with the most senior ranking instruments of the bank. So the most senior ranking preference shares of the bank or other instruments of the bank qualifying as the most senior form of Tier 1 regulatory capital of the bank. Where we disagree with the trustee, however, is Subsection 2 does not simply relate to instruments of affiliates of the bank. What Subsection 2 says is it relates to instruments where the bank has undertaken a payment obligation. So Subsection 2 says preference shares or other instruments qualifying as consolidated Tier 1 regulatory capital of the bank or any other instrument of any affiliate of the bank, subject to a guarantee or support agreement of the bank.
Why don't we have an ambiguity here?
Well, I think when you look at the document...
In the lengthy footnote, the court, I believe, spun out at least four hypotheticals or four alternative interpretations, you know, which just by their own weight suggest that maybe there's an ambiguity. The reasoning of the court's opinion is certainly, you know, for that side of the case is arguably plausible or more than plausible, but so is the other side. So why don't we have an ambiguity?
Well, Your Honor, I don't agree that their reading is plausible, and the reason for that is when you look to the agreement as a whole, when you look to other instruments executed at the same time, it becomes fairly clear that the lower court's reading of the parity security provision is the only one that actually gives full effect to each of the terms there.
Well, the other side makes the same argument in support of its side. The court characterized the other side's reading as the natural or more natural reading and was able to spin out four alternative interpretations just by manipulation of the language. So I ask you again, how is it that we, you know, should be holding as a matter of law that only your side's interpretation is, you know, the correct interpretation is a matter of law?
Well, I think that the court also said below that the more natural reading is not actually the standard that applies to deciding whether or not or interpreting the contractual language. And what the court specifically said was you need to look at the language, the other documents executed at the same time, and the other provisions. And we believe that when you look at all that, it becomes clear that the subject to language in the subsection 2 of the parity security agreement must modify each of the three instruments listed there.
So if you only look at other documents, if there's an ambiguity, is that correct?
Well, no, Your Honor. I believe that you can look to, and under the Crown Books case, you can look to other documents executed contemporaneously therewith to inform the reading. And the only thing the court looked to another document for was the definition of or, and that was contained in the trust agreement. And what the definition of or was that it was meant to be read inclusive. And the only ground that the trustee claims that the lower court erred is that it misapplied inclusive or. And we believe that that's not the case. If you look at what the lower court found, it said that the subject to, well, first of all, it went with the premise that preference shares, as that term is contained in subsection 2, could not be unmodified because it would be subsumed in the reference to preference shares in subsection 1. And then based on that, what it said was that the use of inclusive or suggested to it that the subject to language should apply to each of the instruments set forth in that subsection. And the court need only look to footnote 87 of the lower court's opinion, where the court specifically noted that it reached its conclusion after parsing the existing language and reference to other provisions of the LLC and the trust agreement. So because the or was inclusive,
let's assume hypothetically that we were to find that there's an ambiguity, that ordinarily would require an evidentiary hearing to determine what the parties intended.
Correct.
If that were the case, would your side be introducing any more evidence into the record in a hypothetical remand hearing? Or do you agree with Mr. Seitz that whatever evidence there is already in the record?
No, we do not agree with that. And we think to the extent that the court finds that the term is ambiguous, that it would require remand to the lower court to develop the record in terms of what the extrinsic evidence is. I guess
I may have misspoken, by the way. I didn't mean to fail to recognize the other side's argument that if we were to find an ambiguity, then contra preferentum would apply.
And let me address that, Your Honor. In terms of contra preferentum, first of all, in Delaware, I think the case law is fairly clear that it's not to be used as a substitute for doing the difficult work that sometimes is involved in parsing the existing language. But even if the court were to apply the doctrine, what that doctrine says is where agreements are not the product of a bilateral negotiation, that any ambiguity within the document should be construed against the drafter. And here, despite the trustee's arguments, they have not developed the record in any regard concerning the drafting of the Commerce Bank documents in 2006.
Well, was your side going to argue that the ultimate investors actually participated in the drafting of the documents?
Well, Your Honor, I right now the record doesn't say one way or another if that's the case. And I think just like this court did in C Management, it was an issue of a limited partner agreement, and there were thousands of limited partners. On remand from a preliminary injunction, the court directed the lower court to undertake discovery relating to the circumstances surrounding the drafting of the agreement and determine whether it was the limited partners had any input in drafting of the agreement.
So your position, and tell me if I have it right, is that were this court to find that there's an ambiguity, in any event, there would be a need for an evidentiary hearing on remand, to determine whether the factual predicate for application of the contra preferentum rule exists, and then B, to permit your side to argue that it shouldn't, and the court should determine the intent based on the evidentiary merits rather than under a presumption.
I think that's right, Your Honor. And I think the evidence in terms of the extrinsic evidence that's currently in the record, that extrinsic evidence relates to statements made in 2009 after the merger between Dresdner Bank and Commerce Bank. And we would submit that that does not go in any way to the intent of the parties at the time of drafting. And even if it were to be used as a course of dealing like the trustee claims, we would submit that the best course of dealing is the fact that we're standing here today. The bank made payments on the DresCap certificates in 2009 and did not make payments on the trust preferred securities in 2010. So just quickly going back to the support in the LLC agreement for the reading that the lower court gave the parity security provision, the junior security definition we believe supports our interpretation of the provision. What the junior security definition captures are preference shares or other instruments of any affiliate of the bank subject to any support agreement or guarantee. And again, like the parity security provision, preference shares in that provision cannot be unmodified. Now, the trustee points out that the reference to other instruments qualifying as consolidated Tier 1 regulatory capital of the bank does not appear there. But we would actually submit that that supports the fact that that term has to be given meaning in the parity security definition, and we think we do that by our reading. Now, the trustee claims that that's not the case because it says that the reference to other instruments qualifying as consolidated Tier 1 regulatory capital would essentially, they say in their briefing, they can't imagine an instrument that would fall under that prong but not also be an instrument of an affiliate of the bank. And we would submit that that assumption is based on the notion that only instruments of an affiliate of the bank can qualify as consolidated Tier 1 regulatory capital. and we don't believe that there's any support in the record for that assumption. Section 2C of the support undertaking, we also believe supports the lower court's reading of the parity security definition. What Section 2C says is it lists out the obligations of the bank, and within the obligations of the bank, it has a mirror provision to the parity security provision. And so for preference shares or other instruments qualifying as consolidated Tier 1 regulatory capital of the bank or any other instrument of any affiliate of the bank to be an obligation of the bank, we submit that it has to be modified by the subject to language. The trustee also argues for the first time on appeals that even if our reading of the parity security definition is right, that that the dress cap instruments would qualify under that reading because they say that the dress cap certificates have the functional equivalent of a support undertaking. As I noted, this is an argument that was not raised in connection with the summary judgment motion below. They did raise it after the court had essentially granted the summary judgment motion and ordered additional briefing on a separate issue. But it was not something that was before the court on the summary judgment motion. And we would note that the court below specifically found that there was no issue of fact as to whether there was a support agreement or undertaking in connection with the dress cap certificates. And we would submit that that's a finding that's subject to clear error review, and there's no basis in the record to find that the court below was in clear error. And we'd also suggest that the notion of whether or not this is a whether the dress cap documents have what is the functional equivalent of a support undertaking is also a question of fact that the trustee is asking this court to decide on appeal, and we don't think that's appropriate. At the end of the day, what the dress cap certificates have and what the trust preferred securities have are two separate things. There's a support undertaking in connection with the trust preferred securities that simply doesn't exist in connection with the dress cap certificates. And in any event, the trustee does not in any way try to argue that whatever they believe is the support undertaking under the dress cap certificates in any way ranks pari passu with the obligations of the bank under the support undertaking. And actually, if what they're arguing is the subordinated note that's the functional equivalent, the support undertaking specifically says that subordinated debt of the bank ranks above the obligations of the bank under the support undertaking. I'll move on to the second issue, which is the pusher provision, which Your Honor raised. Now, as I discussed earlier, whether or not the court reaches this issue will depend on whether or not it finds that the dress cap certificates are parity securities. But to the extent the court does find that the dress cap certificates are parity securities, the question is whether payment in 2009 on the dress cap certificates, a year that both the dress cap certificates and the trust preferred securities were fully paid, pushes a payment on the trust preferred securities in 2010. And contrary to what the trustee argues, we are not asking the court to read any additional terms into the pusher provision. What we are saying is the plain language of the pusher provision provides limits to fiscal years. So if in any fiscal year, as long as the aggregate amount paid on the trust preferred securities for the relevant Class B payment period as against the amount payable bears the same relationship as the amount paid on a parity security as against the amount payable for that same fiscal year, the trust preferred securities and the parity securities have been treated equally. And you have to look at what the intent of this provision is. The intent of the provision is to ensure that parity securities are treated equal with the trust preferred securities. Now, the trustee would break the pusher provision up into a number of different parts. It says that there's a payment trigger, a timing clause, and a payment formula. But despite the trustee's argument, there's no those terms, timing clause, payment trigger, and payment formula, appear nowhere in the LLC agreement and do not appear in the offering memorandum. And what the offering memorandum actually makes clear is that the treatment of the securities is based on a fiscal year. If the provision that the trustee claims is the payment formula, which we claim is the method by which you determine whether there's been equal treatment, if that were truly a payment formula, then we submit there would be no reason for the last section of the pusher provision, which provides basically that to the extent there's a partial payment on a trust preferred or on a parity security, the trust preferred security should get equal payment. The trustee also points the court to the junior security provision. And if you look at the junior security provision, it is true that it is not there is no fiscal year limitation. But the fact that there's no fiscal year limitation does not necessarily mean that you should read out the language relating to a fiscal year in the parity security or in the parity pusher provision. And the reason for that is that parity securities are to be treated the same. If there's a payment on a junior security, one can imagine a situation where they would require that to push a payment because that payment is being made to the detriment of the parity security holders. And if you look to section 9.01B, which is in the record at A200 of the LLC agreement, and that's the deemed declaration provision, what that provides is it specifically notes that it says that parity security, it deals with when there's a push. So if there's a push and there's no deemed declaration, this provision requires that there automatically be a deemed declaration. And what this provision provides is it says that the bank or any of its subsidiaries declares or pays any capital payments, dividends, or other distributions on parity securities in any fiscal year or pays on any junior distributions as contemplated in Section 7.04. So clearly from that provision, there was meant to be a distinction between how parity securities were treated and how junior securities were treated. Now, the trustee also relies on the EuroHypo case and says in its briefing that the court there essentially determined that a similar pusher provision had no fiscal year limitation. And that's simply not the case. That case was a ruling on a motion to dismiss. What that case said, the vice chancellor below said, the plaintiffs have set forth this reading, the defendants have set forth this reading, I'm not going to decide which reading is appropriate, and I'm not going to dismiss the case. And in doing that, the vice chancellor specifically said that the defendants might be right that the provision makes more sense when read according to their interpretation, unless the pusher provision only applied to providing the trust preferred securities with equal treatment in a given fiscal year, there would be little reason for the reference to the fiscal year. I'd also note, too, in that case, we were dealing with a different pusher provision and not the one at issue here. Finally, on the third question that the trustee raises, they claim that the DRESCAP certificates, which were restructured in March 2010, that restructuring violated the support undertaking that was executed in connection with the trust preferred securities. Now, again, assuming that the court finds that the DRESCAP certificates are parity securities, that's the only point it needs to reach this issue. The bank's obligations under the support undertaking are to guarantee that the LLC will be in a position to meet its obligations when those obligations become due. And those include making capital payments and making the redemption payment, if that were to become due. And it also provides the right to, it provides a guarantee that the LLC will be in a position to make the liquidation payment if the liquidation preference is due. Section 6 of the support undertaking, the bank undertakes that it will not give any guarantee or similar undertaking with respect to or enter into any other agreement relating to the support or payment of any amounts in respect to any parity securities. And it also says that if it does that, it needs to modify the support undertaking to rank pari passu and have the same obligations of that mirror undertaking that was entered into in connection with the parity security. And so the trustee says that the restructuring of the DRESCAP 4 certificates breached Section 6 because it was an agreement by the bank for the payment with respect to a parity security. And we think that, at least for two reasons, the trustee is wrong. First, the only payment obligation that the bank undertook in connection with the restructuring of the DRESCAP certificates was the bank's obligation to make principal and interest payments on the subordinated note. So it has nothing to do with the, it's not a payment relating to the parity security. And second, we think that the trustee ignores the language in Section 6 that refers specifically to a guarantee or similar undertaking with respect to a parity security, and instead focuses only on the language that talks about a payment. And we think when you read the whole section in context, it becomes clear that what they're talking about is a support agreement or a guarantee. Now, like I said, the support undertaking has a limited remedy. The only remedy is to modify the support agreement to rank pari passu with the new obligation that the bank has undertaken. And here, there's nothing to modify. There's nothing that we can modify the support undertaking to rank pari passu with. And finally, the remedy the trustee seeks, which is elevation of the COBA Trust 2 securities to be Tier 2 capital, or to Tier 2 status, is just not a remedy that finds any support in the support undertaking. So with that, unless the court has any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is the argument that really makes your head hurt when you try and get through all this. I just have one point to make on rebuttal, and that is this issue of ambiguity and what to do next if there's an ambiguity found. I was a little surprised to hear them try and reserve a position that there ought to be a remand to go into the drafting history of the instruments. And the investors were not involved in drafting these instruments. I think we should have agreement on that point. And this was done on a stipulated record, and as the court below found, and I'm quoting from the court's opinion, whereas here the parties have filed cross motions for summary judgment, the court shall deem the motions to be the equivalent of a stipulation for decision on the merits based on the record submitted with the motions, unless one party presents an argument there is an issue of fact that would be material to the disposition of either motion. It's a stipulated record. The investors were not involved in drafting the documents. Any drafting history was within the control of the bank. It could have been introduced as part of the summary judgment record. It was not. So what is the logical conclusion of that? It is that contra proferentum should apply here. It applies with great force when investors do not have the ability or did not participate in the drafting. The record is as it is, and I would say that the only record evidence here is conduct of the bank, which treated these as parity securities.
Well, if that is so, that argument would apply only to the parity securities issue, leaving then the push provision dispute.
It would, and my plea to the court on that would be that is an issue of law. You are construing a contract provision. There are no facts to be determined. Again, this was done on a stipulated record, which dealt with the pusher provision below, although it was not reached by the court, and that to, in the interest of judicial economy and not spending another 2 years in the lower court to do more on what is, in essence, an issue of law construing the pusher provision, that we would ask in the interest of judicial economy that this court reach that issue as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.